This is a written and recorded podcast. The City of Stonington's 2018 Untitled Literary Festival featured the founder and CEO of the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, Con Karapaniotidis. In this podcast, Con discusses his memoir, The Power of Hope, with written and recorded Serpil Şenelmiş.
On behalf of Stonington Libraries, as part of our 7th Untitled Literary Festival, Con and Serpil will be discussing Con's recent book, The Power of Hope, which looks at the power of community and compassion. Please join me in welcoming Con and Serpil.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for being here tonight. I'd like to introduce you to a man who really needs no introduction, Con Karapaniotidis. Founder of and CEO of Australia's Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, the largest independent human rights organisation of refugees and people seeking asylum in Australia. Now, he's won a swag of awards, including an Order of Australia Medal and Human Rights Medal. Last month, he received the Migration Institute of Australia Distinguished Service Award for recognition for 17 years of pro bono legal work as a lawyer protecting the human rights of people seeking asylum. Give him a round of applause. Now, I see you as a bit of a justice warrior. You've been fighting on behalf of other people for so long, even though you've had your own struggles in life. Where does that sense of justice come from?
Good question. I'll start by paying my respects to the fact that we gather on the land of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung people, and that if we're going to come together talking about welcoming refugees, we need to start by welcoming our first peoples and recognising them and making sure that they live equally and justly in this country as well. So I just want to start with that. One of my passions is volunteering on an Indigenous Children's Board, which I have done for 6 years now. And every time I go up to Alice Springs, I'm staggered by the fact that half of the men my age are dead. And I'm staggered by the fact that it's like apartheid South Africa up there. And 100% of young people imprisoned up there are Indigenous. So we should feel an equal rage for what is happening to First Nations people as we do to what is happening to people seeking asylum. In terms of the question of where does my sense of justice come from, it comes from my heart, and it comes from my lived experience, and it comes from my story, and it comes from my journey. And my work is never some abstract intellectual exercise. This isn't a career. This isn't a job I do. This is just the person that I am. And I recognise very clearly and very early on in my life that I have simply won the birthright lottery of time and place that I talk about in my book, which is I'm nothing special, I'm just lucky. And I stand on the shoulders of my late father and my extraordinary mother. I stand on the shoulders of my grandparents, who on my dad's side were refugees, and I'm just lucky. And every time someone walks through the door at the ASRC, I think, that could be me. That could have been my parents or my grandparents, and what would I want for them? We are constantly told that caring for refugees is somehow complex, and yet there's a simple question, which is, if there is a person in need, and if I can help them, why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I protect them? Why wouldn't I help them? So it comes from the idea that we all have a moral duty to be better and to do good and to help others and to love and to care. And it's not more complicated than that.
Now, I want to talk about your family. You mentioned your family. So you are the son of poor Greek migrants who came to Australia, and your dad was the son of refugees from Ottoman-era Turkey, my ancestors. They shaped the person that you are today. Can you talk about how they shaped the person that you are? You say in the book they taught you about resilience, and they taught you about courage, and they taught you about principles. Would you have been the person you are today without their experiences?
No. And I think, I talk quite honestly in the book both about the good ways in which all the great things I've taken from my parents and also all the hard things that have come from my childhood as well. And the good things are, you think about the migrant experience and you think about the idea of coming to a new country, not by choice, even though you're not fleeing for your life. My parents came as immigrants. You think about putting on hold your dreams, your aspirations, your loves, your potential, your possibility, just so that the next generation, your children, can have it all. Like you are literally suspending the sky and your imagination and your hope and your love for what you could be simply so that your children can. Like my mother would say to me every day, I work like this, like an animal in factory, so no one can treat you this way, so you're never disposable in the way that I am. My father would be up at 4 a.m. I mean, my father, when he was alive, used to tell me multiple times every year about when he was taken out of school. He's 9, his teacher's begging his parents, don't take Leo out. He could be a doctor, he could be a lawyer, he could be anything, please don't. And my dad would always tell me this story, never to shame me or like, why did you get to be that and not me? But he always wanted me to know that he could be something more, that he was meant for something more. My dad and I always had a really hard relationship because he had gone through so much trauma. I mean, he grew up with the Nazis in his village. He grew up 9 years of age. My mum told me recently at 5 he was in the fields working. So he never got to be a boy. He never got to be a child. He never got to play and to dream. And our relationship was quite a fractious one at times because I was wanting him to let go of that hurt and that anger. And I didn't know until I was writing this book, just to understand just how much trauma there was in my family and how that trauma passes on through generations. So they taught me empathy, love, resilience, perspective. My dad was the sort of person that he'd get on a bus and if it was in between paydays and he was short of money, he'd say to the bus driver, is it okay if I pay you next week? And I'd be like, no worries, Leo. He'd do the same when he'd go to the bottle shop for a slab of beer. My father was someone, can you imagine doing that? My father was someone that was just so pure in his trust of people and of his acceptance of people. And I hope I'm a little bit like that. And my mother is like a force of nature. In any other generation, my mother would have been a judge, a CEO of some extraordinary company. She is the force of 10 men. And again, I watched the grief that she also carries at the life she never got to live. So on the one hand, I talk in this way of what they gave me. On the other hand, I grieve for both of them because where do you take that grief? Where does that grief go? Where does that loss go? Where does that go? And you start to realize as you get older, it goes nowhere. It just becomes corrosive and it just slowly eats away.
Let's dig down a bit further into that grief because I think it's a common migrant story. I mean, your family had real trouble adjusting to the Australian way of life. Mm. And I don't think that's uncommon for migrants who come to this country. I mean, I know from my own personal story that I watched my mother weep days on end because of homesickness and not fitting in. Do you think that perhaps first generation Australians carry a sense of PTSD or a sense of trauma that had been passed down to them?
Oh, they do. I mean, when I was writing this book every day, it was a catharsis and I cried every day writing this book. And the days I was weeping because I was just thinking through joining the dots of the man I am now and understanding how that trauma's played out on me and how that trauma's played on my relationship with my dad and my mum. And then realizing, like, when you are displaced, you experience war. My dad's parents fled for their lives, raised 7 children. You start to go, well, that's incredible trauma. And then when you come to a country that, in fact, is racist and has this pressure to constantly assimilate, it doesn't happen that often now, but my mother will still sometimes have people come up to her and go, this is Australia, speak Australian. And my mum will turn to them and go, get f***ed.
That's one way to do it.
She'll say that, she'll go, both my children are lawyers and you're just a convict. And my mum will actually say that. But my mum, 50 years later, still talks about not actually feeling like she can call Australia home. And it's easier now for Greeks. But we know as immigrants or as refugees that our identity is tenuous, that our place here is fragile. And I see this in so many of the Greeks I know where they've shortened their names or so many of my ethnic friends where they don't even know how to speak their own mother tongue because their parents were scared that if their kids stood out that they would be punished like they once were. And you see this trauma, you see this pressure for us to assimilate. That is, this is a country that's happy to have us when they can objectify us, exoticize us, appropriate our cultures and our knowledge and our ways, but they don't want us to have a voice or an identity. And they'll see us only when they can problematize us, when you see what's happening with Sudanese and Somalians right now. Like, how did we have the other week a Greek man like me who ran over six people on Bourke Street, and no one's calling me out or asking me to explain my people, and a Muslim Somali man who killed one person tragically, and suddenly the whole community needs to take responsibility. Migrants and refugees get a very clear lesson of who's one of us and who's not. If we can kick a football, if we can run, you're one of us. And if you cook good food or you're attractive, you're one of us. But the minute you breach this unspoken code of whiteness and white privilege and white entitlement, you're the other. And so that's relevant because what I'm trying to get across is so much of the bigotry and racism towards refugees is in migrant communities as well. And people are often like, oh God, they're so ungrateful. Why are they turning on their own? And that pressure to assimilate and that trauma of immigration is so deep that the minute you see that next group of people coming, you're like, I finally made it after 40 years and these people are going to ruin it all. Oh yeah, what are these? Well, I came the right way. So we are dealing with a traumatized community with a pressure of assimilation, and we need to recognize the impact and harm that does.
But doesn't it also relate back to some of the thinking that the migrants and refugees bring from their homeland as well? Because racism is not an exclusive thing in Australia. There's racism in all countries towards different races, and everyone's had their past wars and their past history and their past hatreds, which they also bring with them to Australia, unfortunately. So does that not then add to the complexity of the conversations around racism?
I'm not exactly sure what the question is. If the question is one about do we bring our own traditions and they create challenges in themselves? Look, ethnic parents, especially ethnic mothers, are great at making you feel like you're always going to be disappointing. So I think that's a universal ethnic experience. And ethnic uncles are great at that. I remember once an uncle drew a picture and he said, this is life. And he drew this circle and he goes, 99% of it is life itself. And that is people who are married and people who have children. And he goes, Con, you're the other 1% on the outside. So there's always those pressing expectations, and we all bring our histories and our stories. But in reality, when we're having debates, for example, about Sudanese African gangs, 87% of chronic youth offenders are born in this country. In reality, we bring so much more than whatever challenges we might bring. Yes, the challenge for a new migrant or refugee is one that initially is arduous and challenging, but we have enriched this country many, many, many times over. And we are constantly having to, like, as I said, a man goes and does that awful thing on Bourke Street and suddenly an entire people's right to be here is in question. I would love more of the narrative to be about the way in which we've contributed and helped build this country along with Indigenous people and what we've given to this country, because we enrich it. We enrich it. You know this. I mean, if I was to get you all to stand up now, if your ancestors or you came by sea or land in search of a better life to this country, almost everyone in this room would be standing up. And if I asked you to tell me about their journey and whether they're heroes or villains in your story, they're all heroes. And if I asked you to think about, do the words burden, threat or problem come to mind when you think of your ancestors, all of you would say no. So in other words, my story, the stories of the refugees, is your story. And it's really important we remember that at a time where we're being told to focus on what separates us rather than what binds us. That is, most people are good, most people are compassionate, most Australians are beautiful people. And if we actually nurtured and focused on that, we'd have a very different country than the one we have.
But how do we change that narrative, Con? Randa Abdel-Fattah wrote a lovely article in, I think it was in The Guardian this week, and she talked about how she's sick to death of having to take responsibility for the actions of other Muslims because it's not a homogenous community and you can't just camp them all into one category because they come from different countries, come from different cultural influences, different education. Yes. So how do you change that narrative when even your government is demanding that the Muslim community take responsibility for the actions of one sole person?
Yeah, and it's really challenging because only white people get to be mentally ill. Brown people get to be terrorists. And I've been quite serious. Like somehow one human being can speak for 1.7 billion people globally. But we've had a woman killed every 66 hours in the month of October to November. We've had more women killed by male violence in the last 3 months than we have Australians killed by terrorism in this country in 103 years. We have the police called every 2 minutes to the family home. The leading preventable cause of death, injury and disability in women aged 18 to 45 is the violence of men that they know. Now that's an epidemic. And we spend more money on statutes of Captain Cook than we do on domestic violence services at a federal government level. Now, the reason I raise that is no one is actually asking men to actually take a good hard look at themselves. Rather, women are having to do all the work. So it's actually white people's problem, actually racism, because that's where that racism resides. So they actually need to check their entitlement and their privilege. Just like the epidemic of violence against women is men's problem, it's actually a men's issue, rather than women having to sit there constantly regulating their behaviour. Now, we unfortunately also have to take responsibility for this, like as in I have to spend a lot of my time teaching people how to not to be awful people and how to be human. We do work called the Right Track Project, which is actually, we did research on this, going, why can't we shift the narrative and why can't we change the conversation? What we found was a lot of what we were trying to do, they're not illegal, they're not queue jumpers, they're not terrorists. We actually found our myth-busting was making it worse because all people heard was, oh, so there is a queue, so they could be terrorists. And we actually found we were making it worse. And what our research showed us is we actually need to frame it and focus it on values. They are people like us. It's exhausting even having to do this with people, to tell the truth. You know, they are people seeking asylum. They are people who love their family. They are people who want to contribute and integrate and participate. And what our research found was 1 out of 4 Australians are already on board, 1 out of 2 Australians, 50% are persuadable, and 1 out of 4 Australians will never change. And they were predominantly old, white, uneducated men. And they're the same men that think Pauline Hanson is the second coming, who actually would vote for Mark Latham if he was in office right now, and actually bought Tony Abbott's battle lines at full price. So how you shift it is you actually go back to one thing, which is values. Stop being facetious for a moment, is values. Because people are driven by two things, fear and values. So our government has spent 2 decades poisoning our hearts, and that's why we are where we are. 2 decades telling us they're going to take our jobs, they're going to take our lives, they're going to take our way of life. They're overwhelming us. Our borders are not safe. And they've taught us to dehumanise them on water operational matters. It's the same as when a 2-year-old child from the RIC comes to the centre and you ask their name and they quote you their boat ID number rather than their name. Or they call everyone guard because that's their childhood experience. So we know dehumanisation works. We have a history of that in countries like Nazi Germany, where you dehumanise a people and then you're able to do anything. And I'm not for a moment comparing the horrors of the Holocaust to what our government is doing, but I'm talking about the theme of dehumanisation. And our government has learned that very well. Dehumanise the people, teach you that they are a threat, that they do not share our way of life, that they are less than us, and you will in return let our government do whatever is needed to keep us safe from that horde of savages that are coming to take away our happiness and prosperity and our freedom. And we'll even let our government torture children in open, wide spaces at the same time as we're making national apologies on institutional child abuse. We'll torture children at the same time in full public view. We won't even have to hide it this time. And that's what fear does. And how we change that, as attitudes are changing, as 80% of Australians want kids off Nauru, as the majority of Australians want those offshore centres closed, people are changing. And they're changing through values, through conversation, through education, and through actually seeing the human cost of these policies and starting to realise there actually are alternatives to them.
Speaking of the children, when you first started working with Asylum Seeker Resources Centre, you encountered something that most people would see as tragic. You got a distress phone call from a man called Amir, and he told you that his 10-year-old daughter had attempted suicide. It wasn't the first time, but the time that he called you was one of the worst. I mean, that story had a happy ending because those people are now Australian citizens and they're here. But we're seeing that story happen time and time again now. So can you articulate the experience of that trauma, of that grief that these families go through because you're talking to them firsthand?
I'll tell you a story. It didn't make it to the book. The editor just didn't feel that it fit in there. And I had to agree with him, but I've been telling this story a lot when I do talks, and I should apologise in advance. Some of the things I talk about, I try to sanitise them as much as I can and try not to be graphic, but some things I talk about might be triggering. So if any of this stuff is too close to the bone, I'm probably just giving you a warning. And I apologise, it's not to distress you, it's for you to understand the human face of what we're doing to refugees and what I see. There was a father I was working with, and he'd been waiting 6 years for an outcome, being constantly rejected, and the minister at the time rejected him on humanitarian grounds again. This was a father that for the last 3 years hadn't been allowed to work. His teenage son, all of 17, had work rights. They'd given it to the son, but not the father. A little baby girl, gorgeous little baby girl. And we were having to break the news that he was going to be refused again. And I talk a lot in the book about what it's like to just be waiting and waiting and waiting. And so often fathers are separated, missing that first step of your baby, that first word, that first birthday. And just the waiting, the torture of the waiting. So one of my lawyers goes down to break the news and I go to support her. And by the time I get down there, she'd already told him. And I find this man having shoved something into his mouth. And what I realise is this man had swallowed a whole jar of sleeping tablets. And I shove my hand in there trying to dig them out of his mouth. And it's too late. He swallowed them all by now. And I'm trying to get control of him. He's a huge man. And refugees are never trying to harm me. I've maybe feared for my safety once in 17 years. Like, it is always themselves. The last thing they have is their body. That's all they've got control of left. So I'm trying to get control of him, and I don't realise that he's got a razor blade, and he has gone and slashed his arm, and he's just bleeding the blood. He's probably making it look a lot worse than this, but it's just blood is just pouring out. And I grab his jumper off the ground, and I'm bandaging his arm, trying to stop him from bleeding out. And I'm just begging him, I'm trying to wrestle his arms because I'm scared he's going to keep cutting himself and get control. And I'm just saying, please stop, please stop, please stop. And this hulk of a man, he just, I still remember, this is many years ago, he just starts weeping in my arms. He's just weeping and his whole body just crumples into me. And all he just keeps saying is, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, Con. And I've been there many times with people where people are just broken. And they don't want to die. They want to live, but all they've got left is that. So every time you hear our government saying, oh, we're being manipulated, and we're working, we had the youngest child we're working with that tried to kill themselves is seven. How does a seven-year-old even conjure such a thing in their imagination? And I've just seen so many people broken, people who came here healthy and strong. They had suffered, but they were resilient and healthy. And in fact, what we've done to refugees here is much worse than what they've fled. Because as they say to me, it's the torture on the inside of going from nothing to zero every day and of being reminded that I am not welcome, that I am not safe, that I'm not home. And that just enrages me to this day. I've got to call a man tomorrow, a man asylum that I'm helping, who's going blind. He's going blind. And he's telling me about part of the pain in his body. He's been there 5 years. Is the bullet that he was shot with while he was in Sudan that's still in his body five years later. That bullet's still in there. And he's losing his sight. So I need you to feel the same rage that I do, but then do something positive with it. I don't just want you to sit there and go, oh, this is all awful and despair, because the whole point of my book is actually to go, we are not going to despair. That despair is not a strategy, that it actually is love and hope and compassion and taking that anger and doing something constructive with it, taking that poison and making medicine out of it, being heard, speaking up, doing something. But I need you to know just how bad it is. Because this is why you should feel that rage, and this is why we need to act, and this is why we need to hold this government and anyone else. And unfortunately, this is bipartisan. Despite the good people in the ALP that there are, this is bipartisan. You have two political leaders that neither has the moral compass or courage to actually end this shameful chapter. And this is why we are where we are. And that's what keeps me going. I cannot bear man-made suffering. You can understand things that can happen that are beyond your control, but when it's deliberate and when it's purposeful, and refugees deserve better, and we deserve better. Sorry, I'm ranting. I better stop. You've got lots of questions there.
No, that's fine, Con. I was just thinking, how do you put yourself in the emotional front line day in and day out, having those conversations with not only the refugees but the politicians, and pick yourself up every day and dust yourself off and get on with the day, because these are tough conversations. I mean, at one point, it must have broken you.
Yeah, look, many times. I'm blessed at the ASIS to have so many incredible staff and volunteers. I mean, anything I do is a little part of what thousands of people do. And a lot of what grounds me, as I talk about in my book, is my childhood. I grew up feeling a deep sense of despair. So when I do this work, I actually feel heartbroken that people are suffering, but it feels familiar to me. And I don't struggle with it, to tell you the truth. As in, I don't ever feel overwhelmed. I know that sounds, I don't mean it in an arrogant way, I just mean this is my people and this is what I believe in. So when I'm in that space, I actually know what I'm doing and I know I'll find a way out of this. And we've never had anyone die in our care in 17 years because the people I work with are so incredible. And it's about remembering that we're not the victim in this. So this is traumatizing. And so, yeah, it does have an impact, like as in, I'll get overwhelmed and what will you do? You'll turn to food and comfort. You'll struggle in your personal relationships and at times with intimacy. You'll pull away from friends at times. You'll hide in work at times as well because you're still in control, as overwhelming as it is. It does all sorts of awful things to you. It actually, last year I was writing this book, it was an awful year. I thought I was possibly had chronic heart disease the year before I had pneumonia. It does take a toll on you, and it's always about recognizing that you need to also look after yourself in all of that as well. I don't ever want to not be crying when I talk about this, and I don't ever want to become numb. So the challenge is, how do you stay present but not lose yourself in all of that?
I mean, in a large part of the book, you also talk about you as a person and your personal life. And one of the things that struck me was that you talk about how you really didn't like yourself. There's a moment in the book where you say you're staring at yourself in the mirror. I think you're around 18 years old, and you look at yourself with utter disgust. Mm-hmm. Was that because you felt different and alien? And you mention a point where you thought you were way too hairier than the Anglo boys, for instance, and that stuck with you. Have you gotten over that?
I've literally got a National Geographic film crew waiting to film my film here. It's like they've found the Yeti. Look, I talk a lot in my book about a lot of things that were really hard to write about, and even things that my editor wanted me to take out because I just felt like I was making myself too vulnerable in the book. And I wanted to write about all of my suffering. I wrote the book first for myself, honestly, when I was asked to write this book and when I eventually agreed to. And then I wrote it hoping that others who are suffering could read my book and go, oh, here's the person I kind of think is okay, and look at all the struggles he's had and look what he's done. And maybe I'm not such a freak or a lost cause or a failure. You know, I grew up in a home that on one hand was profoundly loving, as in no one would have sacrificed or given more. My mother to this day, there's no one who loves me more than my mother. But also grew up in a home of great trauma where they were just constantly in emotional crisis with each other. And so I learned to be the child that had to be the peacekeeper, had to be the one when each was threatening to walk on the other to talk them out of that as a kid. I had to be the one that was the emotional buffer, just taking in all their grief. I understand now they were just doing the best that they could. And at the time, I remember being so angry. And I write about it in my book, you know, there's 13-year-old me that's angry at my dad. Why is he always fighting with my mum? There's 20-year-old me angry at my dad. And then there's 27-year-old me that's just grief-stricken when my dad suddenly dies, and I'd give anything to do it all over again. And so I grew up going to, first in a little country town where it was just wog, you f***ing wog, you dirty wog, go back to your own country. Then I moved to Melbourne, and my parents wanted to send us to private schools. My sister and I refused to. We went to one of the worst public schools, and there it was just being bullied, you know. I was awkward around girls. I had no self-esteem, so my nickname for most years was faggot. And so you learn through racism and bullying, you just the other. You'd go home, you'd hide in the library to hide away from people, you'd go home and cry and go, what have I missed out? How many of us feel that thing where you're like, you've missed out on a class in life around how to be normal or fit in or be popular? So by the time I get to 18, I really, really hated myself. And while I would have killed myself, I very much wanted to die, and I very much despised my very existence and couldn't bear myself. I was just filled with self-loathing and self-hate. I mean, that's something I've actually struggled with all my life. I still, to this day, will have to at times just stop when life gets really fallen and go, you're okay. I still talk myself through this stuff because I think I just grew up with such low self-esteem and no self-worth. And then I was a real late bloomer when it came to relationships and intimacy, to when I even lost my virginity, which I can't tell you after buying my book.
40-year-old virgin.
Not far away. My editor's like, take that out. I'm like, no. But I also wanted to be that honest because I wanted to have a conversation with men. And I deliberately expose myself that much because I wanted to have a conversation about what does it mean to be a man. My father was a loving man, but had no emotional tools. My mother didn't either. I remember feeling anxious when people would hug me when I was an adult because I don't remember touch in that way. I remember growing around lots of just abusive alcoholic uncles, women in the kitchen, the men outside, and I basically had to teach myself over 20 years how to unlearn how to be a man. I just had to teach myself what does it mean to have intimacy? What does it mean to love? What does it mean to be vulnerable? What does it mean to communicate your feelings? What does it mean to be a nurturer? What does it mean to be a caregiver? What does it mean to do your own emotional labor and not expect it of women? What does it mean to relate to women in a way that is an equal, not from a place of control or domination? Like, what does it mean to not be a real man, but to be a decent and good man? And I've spent decades working on that. And I wanted to have this conversation with men because at the moment, the greatest threat to humanity is masculinity. And the greatest threat to women is men. And we need to be having a serious conversation about it's men are dying at record rates. 2,500 a year are killing themselves. And we're losing a woman every week. So I wanted a conversation around that.
So let's unpack the idea of manhood a bit more, because you sort of say in the book, I mean, you mentioned the high suicide rates.
Yeah.
You mentioned the fact that the domestic violence rates are through the roof, that men are living in the shadows, that men are not sharing their emotions, that some men have actually told you, a lot of men have told you that you are anti-men.
Yeah.
And you say that there needs to be a seismic shift in the way that we discuss manhood. So if we bust some of the myths around manhood, how should we redefine manhood in your view?
Well, once you start having a conversation around, well, what does it mean to actually be a man? And you start looking at how arbitrary notions of gender are, and you start looking at how arbitrary notions of masculinity are. The few male friends I have in my life, most of the people in my life are women. What manhood looks like in reality is being able to sit there and talk about how you're going with your mental health. I can see you've been having a hard time. How are you going with your weight? I know you've struggled with your body image. How's that dating going? I know it's hard being out there and feeling rejected. How are you going with work? I can see you had a health scare and you must feel this pressure to constantly be this caregiver and keep going. But I'm sure your partner and your kids don't want that from you. They don't want you in an early grave. It's okay to have boundaries. It's okay to not be perfect. It's okay to not be in control. It's okay to not have to fix things or to have the answer to everything. It's okay to cry. It's okay to know I don't know. It's okay to ask for help. It's okay to say you're overwhelmed. They're the conversations I have with the men in my life. Is a masculinity that is fluid, is able to be as feminine as women are able to be as masculine, that actually allows a safe space for men to be human. And when I talk with the women in my life, who all have relations with men in one way or another, they're just saying, I just want to be able to have equality. And men are like, oh, this equality. I'm like, equality just means women are actually calling you out because they love you, because they actually want to be safe around you and they want to share life with you and they want to have meaning with you, whether that's as your mum or as your friend or as your daughter or as your partner, whatever it is. And I keep trying to say this to them because men get so angry at me. They're like, you're such a sellout, you're such a traitor. And I kind of sit there and go, I'm saying this because I love men, because our natural state is to be loving. It's not to be hurtful. It's not to be isolated. It's not to be despairing. It's not to be, you know, poisoning ourselves as men do through violence and alcoholism and gambling and self-harm and working too hard. And we need to have a conversation as men, and men need to have this conversation. Women have done too much of the work. Women are tired. And it's time as men that we start doing the work and start having these really uncomfortable and difficult conversations.
So what are your expectations of Australians when it comes to all of these issues, whether it be asylum seekers or redefining manhood or basically making progress in our Indigenous community? I mean, you make the point in the book that to be neutral in times of injustice is to be complicit.
Yeah, Desmond Tutu, you know. If you're neutral in times of injustice, you've chosen the side of the oppressor. I talk about a really broad range of issues. I mean, when I got asked to write this book, my publisher said I need it to be about your life and a manifesto to change the world and about the values we should live in, a self-help guide. So the book is quite broad and it covers all those areas. But I write deliberately about everything from a living wage to climate change to Indigenous people to refugees, because these are all our issues. This is all our backyard. When I was 18, you know, I turned this dark corner by taking the love I thought I had in me, but didn't think I could have for myself. And I started giving it out into the community. And what changed my life in my 20s, from 18 onwards, was I went out and started volunteering with terminally ill kids on the streets of St Kilda with sex workers, running support groups for male survivors of child abuse, answering suicide hotlines, working with homeless men. And what I found everywhere I worked were the same people. They were my backyard, they were my people, they were my family. Where just by often misfortune or inequality of some kind, they found themselves on the periphery of being othered, of being less than. And what I'm looking for from Australians is that we should, bless you, that we should care, that we should have compassion. I remember a few years ago, I've worked a lot with homelessness, and I got a chance to run a massage clinic for homeless men. As a way of getting over my own dislike of my own body, I went and became a qualified massage therapist because it was the most terrifying thing I thought I could do. I can't talk about my sweetie's massage naked course right now. We're running out of time. But anyway, there I am running this massage clinic, and these men are rough. Like, these men have, many of them have just come out of prison. Many are sleeping on the streets, tattooed from head to toe. And they'd come into my little makeshift massage room at Ozenham House in Flemington across from the kids' hospital. And I'd go, lie down. Tell me about your day. Take a deep breath and close your eyes. And then I would massage them. And for so many of these men, it was the first time maybe ever or in many years that someone was touching them who wasn't harming them. And these men were so grateful just to be seen. Just to be seen. You know, I've been talking a lot around this country about the need for radical empathy right now in this country. That is, we need radical empathy, and that is at the heart of what I'm looking for, is that we see that we are all people and that we all have stories and that we all matter and that our struggles matter and that all of us are enough and that all of us deserve to be safe and deserve to be heard and deserve to be seen. So at a time where our leaders are telling us that children being safe through safe schools is somehow going to undo our way of life, that bringing them here or acting on climate change or embracing the Uluru statement that the time is not now, well, the time is now. The time is now for all of us. And we have grown tired of people that do not govern for us, but just rule for themselves and their elitist mates. And we want a living wage for the poor. And we want proper childcare for women, and we want action on everything that is close to our hearts. And none of these things are in competition with each other. So every time people are like, well, what about our own backyard? I said to go, well, they're in my backyard, they're my people. Remember, those same people are actually the people that do nothing. You know, you say to them, so what are you doing? And they're like, I do nothing, and I would like you to do nothing too. One of the things we need to stop doing in terms of how do I sustain myself, you asked a bit earlier, I stop apologizing for what I believe and what I care about. I stop justifying it. I stop explaining it. I just get on with doing it. And all I do now is when others sit there going me, I just think, well, what are you doing to help humanity? What are you doing to make this world a bit kinder? What are you giving of yourself? And if the answer is nothing, go and do some work on yourself. I'm busy going out to trying to change the world in whatever little way that I can. And when people often go, this is all so overwhelming, I keep saying to people, don't be overwhelmed. You have all the tools inside of you right now to change the world. You have an open mind, you have a beating heart, and you have the will to do good. That is all you need. That's all you need to actually go out there and change the world. And all that matters is taking that first step in the doing. And once you start doing, you are part of the solution. And why do we do this? Because it's about history, and it's not about history in the future. It's about history that is happening right now. History is in the here and now. History is now. And it actually matters being on the right side of history. It actually matters doing what is right, because this is a universal moral good that transcends every culture and every country. To save a life is to save the world, is a saying that pretty much every culture on earth has for a reason. So the work I do to save a life is to save the world. Saves me as much as it does the people that I work with. And so the call out to all of you, the theme of my book is one of eternal optimism. And I share what I share and all the dark stuff in there because I want it to have an authenticity. I don't want to sit and pretend any of this is easy or that anything good doesn't come from anywhere but from a place of struggle. But I want you to know that that place of struggle is also your empathy and is your love and is your resilience and is your power. Because we're only going to get there as a movement if we're actually willing to love ourselves and accept ourselves and forgive ourselves and have expectations of ourselves and see our power and see our goodness and see our ability to change things. And then we're only going to change things if we then come together collectively across all these issues and do our little bit, whatever that is. Anything is great, but the importance is doing something. The one thing that is unacceptable is having no expectations of yourself and giving nothing of yourself. Because life is too precious and you are too precious to be a bystander to her. And that is the call out in the book.
Con, your book is called The Power of Hope, and you mentioned some of the charities you've worked with. You mentioned massaging the men, you've worked with sex workers, sick children, people with HIV, the homeless. These are people, as you said, who are on the peripheries of society. So what did you learn from them about the power of hope?
I remember one of my favourite experiences was for 4 years, every second Sunday morning, I would volunteer at the Royal Children's Hospital for very special kids. And everyone else was like a 65-year-old grandmother. And then there was 21-year-old me, all hairy and chunky, and they'd look at me like, what is this guy even doing here? Very Special Kids is an extraordinary organisation, and our role is to provide a respite for the mums and dads caring for the children that are dying. And I will never forget these 3, 4, 5-year-old kids who knew they were dying and seeing the resilience in these children and seeing the courage in these children. And I'll never forget the mums and dads when I was sitting there trying to, you know, sidestep. They're like, no, we don't want you to pretend with our children. Our children know what is going on, and we will always be honest with them because that's what love is. And I was so blown away, like, what it would be like as a parent to have your child knowing they're not going to get past 4 or 5 or 6 and yet not be filled with bitterness but with love and gratefulness. And everywhere I've worked, what's always moved me is just the sheer gratefulness of the people that I've worked with. Like, how can you not be bitter? Like, the refugees I work with, how can you not hate this country after what they've done to you? And yet they love it. And they're so desperate to be part of it and be contributed to it. It's so breathtaking. So they've taught me the power of resilience, of humility, of perspective, of gratefulness, and of staying grounded in all of that. And I'm always in absolute, or when I'm up in remote Indigenous communities, when I'm given the honour and I'm talking to elders and I'm sharing what has happened and I'm sitting there waiting for them to be angry and like, going, why are you looking after the refugees? And they're like, this all sounds very familiar to us. Kicking us off our lands, controlling our lives, dehumanising us, taking away our choices and agency. And they're like, it's wonderful what you do. How can we help as well? And it's extraordinary when you're out there on country with people and in seeing the, you realise just also how insignificant you are in a way, that thousands and thousands of generations have come before you, and the power of humanity and of story and of resilience and of hope and of culture and of community. And that's the story. That's our story, is the power of us as community is this power of this love together.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to open the questions to the floor. If anyone's got a question for Con, please put your hand up.
Thanks, Con. At a very basic level, for people that are in this room, writing to ministers, signing petitions, telephoning, get some staffer, and it depends which party they are, how polite they are to you. Is there value in people like us doing those things? And do you think that that had any impact on the reversal of food bank and perhaps the way everyone's thinking about Nauru now?
Of course it does. A really quick example. When you had Russell Broadbent, Julia Banks and Craig Lowndes come out saying we want kids off Nauru, we got thousands of people to call them. When I was talking with Julia Banks, she was talking about being overwhelmed by the support. When Rebecca Sharkey, Adam Band, Andrew Wilkie, the same, they tell you, because when they go into Parliament or they go into their party room, if they've got behind them, I got 300 letters, I got 200 phone calls, I got 50 people turn up. There are so few things Australians actually, we're lazy when it comes to politics. We're not like other countries. We take for granted the right to vote or even a non-corrupt legal system, unlike the midterms in America. We take this for granted. So it's rare for people to actually turn up to someone's office. It's rare to write for people to get a handwritten letter. They notice it. And you're giving them the strength and the cover and the capital to take a stand and speak out. It really does. They sit there and say to us, oh, well, it's when I'm going to shift when people shift. We're like, well, it doesn't work that way. You're meant to lead and then people will follow. But they do say, you tell us people care and yet no one visits. and yet no one calls, and yet no one writes. And I can't stress enough, when we had the good problem of them all calling, going, it's great, we appreciate the support, can you please tell people to stop calling us? We haven't been able to make a call in weeks. Like, they remember this stuff. When I was talking with Julia Banks, when she was going to make that talk, and it's going, you're going to be on the right side of history, as hard as it is right now. And she's like, yeah, I know, there's supports out there. It really matters. But if we do not show that, and I remember having people angry at me, like, how can you be complimenting and thanking three Liberal politicians? I'm like, think how cynical that is. We are where we are because we played politics with refugees. If all we want to do is be constantly outraged and win the Outrage Olympics, great, just be outraged. I'm keeping it real, I'm just constantly outraged. But if you want people to change, when they change and do the right thing, thank them for it. Encourage them, because if you don't, why should they bother? We cannot be so cynical. We've got this binary, left, right, and we are going to just constantly be angry. I want to win. I want to change things. I don't want to be outraged. I'm exhausted by it. And I'm exhausted by seeing what happens to the people themselves. They just want solutions. They don't want us to sit there keeping it real. So it's really important that we use our voice. And when people do the right thing, thank them for it. Let them know that they're not alone and there's support for it. I can tell you now, that's the reason why all those people are still going. They've been overwhelmed with public support.
Hello, I'm Jade. I come from China. And I learn philosophy, psychology, cross-cultural psychology, sociology, history, politics, and neuroscience. Because I want to know what makes a culture and people different. Why some people pursue democracy? Actually, most of Chinese people are against democracy. So I really want to find the answer. What makes culture, society, and people different, in your opinion?
It's a great question, isn't it? And it's obviously in lots of different parts. You start with political leadership because you sit there and say, we need to start by having a thriving democracy and those who lead us inspire us. It's important because if I look at the times of Malcolm Fraser, where he took 250,000 refugees, he had equal challenges there, which were turn them back, Mr. Fraser, lock them up. And when we used to hang out together, I had the great fortune of becoming friends with him. He would say, I was asked to do the very things we do now, and I chose to take a values approach, and I chose to lead with values. And he actually was able to make it for a while there bipartisan, where he'd lead with values. You second ever decentralized media. So just like you have no freedom of press in China, we don't have that here, but we've got our own problems, which is almost a monopolization of our media and an attack on the independence of the ABC. So if you don't have a thriving independent media and you have concentration of it, then what you start having is a narrative that actually is counter human rights. So Rupert Murdoch has built his empire on undermining human rights globally. Third, you need to then look at what is the curriculum in schools and are we actually teaching children core competencies? The parents often say to me, if I was going to teach my kids anything, what should I be teaching them? Empathy, manners, work ethic, humility, kindness, and compassion. You teach your child that, they're going to be a superstar. Where's that taught in school? Empathy, humility, manners, compassion, kindness, art, and resilience. Where's that taught in school? It's taught in almost nowhere. And then at the kitchen table, what are parents? You can't just blame the media, you can't just blame parents. What are parents teaching? And that's the challenge of what have we inherited and what's come before us? What are we teaching at the kitchen table, children? And what are the conversations we're having? Are we having conversations about values? Are we having conversations around what it is to be moral and what it is to be good? So I think it's a complex question around the role of family, of media, of government, of community, of faith, of corporates. Like, Facebook's a great example in crisis at the moment because what it's shown you is it's this sleazeball company that's only just interested in selling off our lives. So we also need to hold businesses now in some countries more powerful than democratically organized elected governments. So we also need to hold business to account, which is us as a community, value our community more than we value, we're more than just an economy. And these are challenges in a capitalist, patriarchal society. I could go on. Those are challenges. So I don't have the fix overnight, but I do think at the heart of it is about raising people with values, leading with values, and the power and importance of healthy debate. And we need to not be afraid in this country. As long as it's not hate speech where people are in danger, we shouldn't be afraid to have a difference of opinion and have a healthy respect for debate and disagreement. Even that seems to be at risk at the moment. Like, it's okay to not agree, but let's do it from a place of respect. I always say to people, it's like, you have two choices. You can either win. Oh, you're a racist, you're an awful person, and walk away and go, see, I told them they're a racist, an awful person. And that person's like, I'm never going to listen to you. Or you can bring people with you, which is either go, look, I know you're afraid of refugees, I'd really love to understand that. I'd love to tell you my story about why this matters to me, and I'd love to hear where you're coming from. and they'll tell their story and go, but what do you think about, but I know you're a mate of mine and I know you really care about family and fairness and community. Well, this is what's happening to the people that I've come across. What do you think about that from a values point of view? And once you start shifting things into values, suddenly you're actually having a conversation about us, not it or the, but us. So we need to also think about, if we're going to have a culture like that, we need to start being kinder to each other rather than trying to win and dominate and be right, but actually go, how do we bring each other together? How do we bring others with us? Because if we're just on our own out there raging away and everyone else is like over there, well, all we build is more silos and more fractured societies. And we've got enough of that already, don't we? And on that note...
Thank you, Con. You've left us with a lot of food for thought.
Con Karapaniotidis is the founder and CEO of the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. He was discussing his memoir, The Power of Hope, with written and recorded Serpil Shinelmish. This podcast was recorded on Sunday, 18 November 2018. You can find out more about other written and recorded podcasts and services at writtenandrecorded.com.